From the Bonnet Couch, Adventure Odd Six Ravenloft came out in 1983. In addition to being the origin of the famous vampire antagonist Strahd von Zurovich, the adventure also featured a unique structure that allowed for the cards drawn by a fortune teller during a reading to randomize elements of the game, making I6 a natural adventure to play multiple times. On top of all this, Konami completely stole the image of Strahd von Zurovich as a stand-in for Dracula on the cover of the 1987 Castlevania II Simon's Quest game. How dare they!
And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D has cast a temporal loop spell over us that we cannot escape.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. In 2021, I kind of became in charge of the whole thing, so, I mean, there's nothing to complain about, but if you want to tell me how awesome it is, you can reach out.
And I am Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I've been gaming since roughly 1985. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about running the same adventure multiple times. Then we'll have some recommendations for D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, in my campaign journal, still no City of Cows game, and unfortunately, there's probably not going to be one until later somewhere. For our last session that we were going to play, the GM had some folks coming in from out of town that I don't know if he had forgotten or it was an unexpected thing, but he confessed that he's got a lot going on right now and wondered if someone else would be willing to step in and run for the next 2 or 3 months. And me, being me, said, sure. Because this group is very polygamerous, we don't always play D&D. And folks requested that we do something else. Because of that, I will be running a Savage Worlds superhero campaign with the group. It's gonna be kind of a Gotham Knights-style adventure, but with the serial numbers totally filed off. Capital City's Night Guardian is missing, and his former protégés and the associates must step in and protect the city while also trying to find out what happened to him. It should be fun. A little bit of street-level Gotham escapades and that type of stuff. In the other campaign, Cygnus de Guerre, Murder Monkeys or whatever it is, Monkeys of War, I think it was it is, we immediately got sidetracked from our mission because we teleported across the continent to a Temple of Mystra gate portal, only to discover the priests weren't acting correctly. In the last session, we spent a lot of time debating, how do we get where we want to go to investigate this artifact? Do we go over land? Do we gate somewhere? Where are there gates? And me and one of the other guys finally just told the GM, you tell us where the gate is and that's where we go. You know, like, there's no debating this. No, just tell us where we're going. We're tired. The player of our sorceress, Bryn, was like, I just want to blow something up. So we arrive in this temple where all of the priests are acting really sus and immediately are like, okay, we're just going. This is a now problem. We basically started barging our way in to be like, hey, we've got a cleric of Mystra with us. He deserves to be able to go in and, you know, make an offering at the altar or whatever it is clerics of Mystra do. And they were trying to stop us. And the priest we were dealing with up front, Arima, our cleric, was a little concerned that he might be under mind control, so requested that we not kill him. So we just knocked him out, which, of course, there was a whole debate about what non-lethal damage meant and all that. It's like, no, he's alive. He is just unconscious. And then we got into the main temple area where we were attacked by two priests and four kind of construct guardians. Mm-hmm. And we locked the door behind us with turn to stone spell that Arima always wants to use. It's like one of his solutions for everything. Anyway, we get into this fight. We kill the other two priests and Tad, our grung wrestler, notices they have some control rods on them. Uses that to make the constructs stop, which gives us a moment to breathe. We realize that the priests are actually priests of Shar, At which point, after having played Baldur's Gate 3 twice, I just finished my second playthrough, my response was, oh, these assholes. The next fight ended up being a bit of a slog because we were fighting some Shadow Knight things that have an armor class of 21.
Ouch.
Who we could barely hit, but they could also barely hit us. So it took a while to get through those. That was that. We ended up stopping there because it was well after midnight. And it's like, okay, we need to stop. And we don't know if in the next session we're going to deal with the unconscious priest and his henchmen that we left in the courtyard, or if, because we think they're about ready to break through the door we had blocked, or head down into the dungeons, which of course will be even more priests of Char shenanigans.
Charnanigans.
Yeah, Charnanigans. We don't actually know if there are any true priests of Mistra here. There could be some priests down in the dungeon who are being held captive. Or it could have been a front for Char the whole time. We don't know. We're just cleaning house.
But also, after that experience you had in Baldur's Gate 3, you don't want to assume that there aren't innocent people to save.
Exactly.
All right, so my monthly Saturday D&D group, which is my daughter and my daughter-in-law and their friend, we did not play D&D this time around because they were helping me playtest something else for an upcoming review. But we did talk about the D&D campaign. And the consensus was they're having fun with what they're playing now, which they started playing with pre-generated characters, and we kind of randomly determined the plot. But now they are very enamored of the idea of making their own characters, picking their own species, deciding their own classes and subclasses. They really are at that point where they want to dig in and make sure that their characters are their own. So next time we play, instead of playing the campaign that we have been playing for a while, we are going to do a session zero, and they are going to make all new characters that are completely their own, you know, from scratch. And I was mentioning possible campaigns, and the minute I said, and then there's Curse of Strahd, and there's this vampire, and they're like, that's the one. Which is handy, because I actually, back in 2020, I bought that Curse of Strahd revamp box set that's shaped like a coffin.
Oh, the really cool shiny one.
Yeah, and it's got like the custom GM screen, it's got the oversized Taroka cards. And I'm like, oh, I wasn't even thinking about this when they said they wanted to play Curse of Strahd. So I actually get to play with a toy that I spent too much money for.
Now, relevant to our later discussion, have you run Curse of Strahd before?
I have not. I've played through Curse of Strahd.
Okay.
That was where I was playing at the local game store, and my character was based on Jasmine from Aladdin. We had a Disney princess party.
Okay, then.
In the Thursday night game, we were dealing with the aftermath of the party finding the Orb of Dragonkind. I thought that this night's play was going to revolve a lot around discussing what they were going to do with the orb, and that is what ended up happening. The way I prepped for this, because it's like, here's an artifact, they don't know what it's going to do, and politically it could set off all sorts of problems. So how I prepped for this is I just had a list of all the people that they would normally run into, and how that person would react to finding out about the Orb of Dragonkind. I had a few people that would have suggestions that they would push them towards one way or the other. And I also had various people that I knew in the city that could help them research it if they were going to go outside to research anything. We ended up having a scene between Kazina and her sister. Kazina's sister did not have any ulterior motives for the Orb of Dragonkind. She just offered to have her smuggler friends try and get it out of the city. That was not the option that they went with. It was interesting because I was ready for people to maybe try and do a little bit more research, but instead of going outside to do research, one, we do have a dragonborn fighter that has a ridiculously good arcana skill.
And I believe he rolled a nat 20.
Yeah, so he learned several pieces of information. For every 5 over the DC, I gave him an extra piece of information, so he picked up like 3 extra pieces of information about the orb there. And also, to get more information about it, our dwarf cleric attuned to the orb, which could have been dangerous, but worked out all right. But I was so close to getting somebody to speak the command word so they could talk to the dragon spirit in the orb. It came up. And it almost happened.
It was funny, the debate on who was going to attune to the the dragon orb because initially Kazina was like, I'll do it. Okay, fine, I'll do it. At which point Marin was like, no, I'll do it. And I'm like, the hell you are. You're a dragonborn. You're not attuning to this. At which point I was finally like, Mazrim does it because he's the most neutral among us. We probably should have had Ivy do it, but Ivy's kind of explosive. It's just little did we know she would have stood the best chance of being able to handle actually talking to the dragon in the orb.
It is interesting, though, because that's one of those balance between game rules and knowing the character, because Ivy has also already like bonded her soul to a void dragon. So maybe she isn't the one that you want to have talking to the dragon spirit in the orb.
She's kind of collecting dragon friends like Pokemon.
So they found out all the information that they were going to find out, mainly that, if they did try and use the power, there is a chance that the dragon spirit could possess the person that was using the orb and it would get free because it really wanted to get loose. And they also found out that even though a powerful enough magic item could destroy the Orb of Dragons, it also sent out destructive shockwaves every time it was hit for damage. So they started planning for this. Marin has a magic trident that was powerful enough to damage it. They decided to sneak it out of town, take it down the coastline, and destroy it by the seaside.
Mind you, we had found out at this point that the dragon inside was probably a powerful sea dragon.
Yes, it was an ancient sea dragon.
Which we decided to destroy the orb next to the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the planning involved making sure that Marin didn't get, blown to pieces from stabbing it, but he actually did a lot more damage and I rolled really low for the concussive force wave that was hitting him. So it took about two blows before the orb finally cracked and exploded and the dragon spirit was freed. Everyone lived happily ever after. No, wait, they didn't. They were next to the sea. It was a sea dragon. In the Midgard setting, sea dragons are very close to their progenitor, who is the sea dragon god Sagotan. Because they destroyed this orb on the beach, Sagotan realized what was going on immediately. He felt the soul of one of his children being, thrown from this plane of existence. So Sagotan kind of hit the pause button and talked to our party for a bit.
Talked. He told us what we were going to do, and we don't have a choice.
Yes, and Sagotan would like them to travel into the Nether Realm, find the soul of the sea dragon, and bring it back to him so that at least her soul is not, in some other god's domain. It's a simple thing. I'm sure you guys can handle it. I love the fact that Marin was so upset that you have to travel to the other planes again.
Yeah, he just does not like planar travel. I mean, maybe we can get him some, anti-planar travel sickness meds or something before we go.
Everyone is 11th level now, so we're getting up there. We're on the back end of the levels that D&D actually provides you rules for. One of the things I really did like in this session, though, was there wasn't tension among players, but there was some tension among the characters. And it was nice to see that because people were thinking from their character's perspective as they were talking about what needed to happen with this orb.
Yeah. And I also especially enjoyed the scene at the very end with Ambassador Darius, who, I mean, he's a smart kobold. He knew something was up, but we still shocked him a little bit with the truth of what was going on.
Yeah, this actually pushed him past the threshold of what he expected out of all of you, and he's got a pretty high threshold. I liked having the opportunity to have that scene between Kazina and her sister, because we did a little bit of that, earlier, but I wanted her to get her feet under her before I started using her for other things in the campaign, and I was glad we could, have that conversation. That was kind of nice.
I mean, she'd been through a lot. She was kind of traumatized. Being almost turned into a hag will do that to somebody.
It will. It will. Even though there were mechanical aspects to what we were doing, this was a lot of role-playing and story development for this session, and I enjoyed that. I think, though, we may have come to the end of my campaign journal. So now let's talk about what we're doing today for the workshop.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Many times when we play D&D, we think about the next thing that we can do, whether it's a new campaign conceived by the DM or the latest hardcover campaign adventure. We tend to think linearly, moving from one new adventure to the next. But what if all the things that you learned from running an adventure one time could be put to good use all over again? Today, we want to talk about running adventures more than once. So, Ange, why would you want to run something that you've already run before?
There's a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, sometimes ideas are worth revisiting. You've run it once before, there might be other things to explore. I just said in my campaign journal that I have just finished my second playthrough of Baldur's Gate 3. It's like there's reasons to replay things. Sometimes it is easy prep. You know, like you need to run, you know, you need to step into the role of GM for a group to keep things going, and it will be easier for you to run something that you are experienced with. Maybe something about running it for the first time makes it worth trying again. Sometimes that could be the first time didn't go as well as you wanted, or you didn't understand it as completely as you wanted, and you want to do over. And then there's conventions. It is always good to have a solid adventure in your back pocket that you can pull out and run at conventions. I don't tend to run D&D at conventions. I do have a D&D adventure that I have run multiple times at conventions and game stores and stuff like that. But for the most part, I run other stuff. But I absolutely love getting to see what different players do with the same problem. You know, like how do different people approach the problem that the adventure is setting forward? What do they do? And it's like so good to see how different people do things. It's really brilliant. It's one of the reasons I love running at conventions.
Honestly, a lot of my experience, at least with D&D type gaming and running adventures more than once, has to do with Pathfinder Society and Adventurers League with organized play.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of times when once you get a scenario under your belt and you understand the ins and outs of it, it's a lot easier to just say, okay, I'll run this for us. Especially if you end up running something because another DM didn't show up or, you know, something of that nature. A lot of times if you know that adventure, you can just put it out there and run it and it's in your head. You know all the little ins and outs of it.
There's absolutely no shame in reusing work you have already done in another time and place. Ideas are good. They're worth revisiting. I mean, there's some other details we'll get into about this later, but we don't watch a good movie once and then never watch it again. Actually, I was in college many, many years ago, and I was in this class, and we were talking about memory and, you know, what would be the bad things about losing your long-term memory or things like that. And I was like, Oh, never getting to reread a book. And there were a couple of people in class like, you reread your books? And I was just like, you don't? Like, the idea that people don't revisit things that gave them joy is like, it's running a game that you have run before is got some different aspects to it, but there are still things of like, there are good ideas in there. Let's revisit them and figure out what's going on.
I also think this is not as common now, but there were some adventures that were kind of major events for certain settings.
Mm-hmm.
And those are another thing that I think people kind of want to revisit with other people because it kind of relives an important part of the setting. Like, I know there are people that have run the original War of the Lance, you know, the Dragonlance campaign in first edition, second edition, third edition, probably not fourth, but they've run it in every edition because they really enjoy that story and they really like Dragonlance and they want to see how someone else puts a spin on how the War of the Lance unfolded.
Oh yeah.
What can you reuse from your previous run of adventures?
Obviously, your notes, the adventure materials you put together are completely reusable, including the monster stats, the encounters you've put together. Honestly, the knowledge of how things went the first time. You know, that can give you an idea of how things might go this time, of how certain players approach things, or, you know, as is inevitable in most games, how you didn't expect your players to approach something in a certain way. And now you've got an understanding of like, oh, players might go that way, or they might go this way that I originally expected them to. So having that foreknowledge of how things went can be super valuable in trying to run that campaign or that adventure a second time, or a third time, or a fourth time, or whatever you're doing.
I know when I was doing this with organized play a lot, one of the valuable things to reuse was literally the tactical maps that I had set up for it. Because I didn't, you know, I did so much work in third edition in Pathfinder, but like I would get like the gaming paper and I would draw out exactly what the encounter was supposed to look like. It is really nice knowing that I didn't have to do that again because I already have it set out for the scenario.
Crafting encounters is like, that is a lot of work.
Oh yeah.
It is a lot of work to, you know, especially if you're doing it from scratch. I mean, it's still even work if you're doing it from a module or a pre-written adventure, because you still need to make sure that that's going to work for the players you have at your table. But like figuring out, you know, how many monsters of what type, where are they going to be? How does this encounter get triggered? What is the landscape of this encounter like?
Mm-hmm.
All of this stuff is work that you have to do up front. And being able to just pick up that puzzle piece and put it in the new game you're running, that's lovely.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I don't think we always realize the amount of mental space that things take up in our heads, because there are times just knowing that, oh, last time I ran this encounter, I started them on these squares and I started the enemies on this square, and not having to think, wait, where should they be? Reading the encounter in the book, it doesn't say exactly where they're at. Where should they go? But I've run it before now, and I knew it worked out fine when I put these here and these here. And that's one less thing that my brain has to go through as I am setting up that encounter. So I got the brain space free.
Or you set up an encounter, and when you ran it the first time, it wasn't quite where you needed to be. So you can adjust it to have things in a better position for this new encounter, for this new group.
And even if you're not going to be a terrible to yourself like I was in third edition and try and draw out all these maps yourself and everything, even something like knowing, oh, that one flip mat that I have that has the image of the hill on it or whatever worked really well for this, you don't have to go through all of your resources and do that stuff again. You already have an idea of how you want to do this. Or, like you just said, you could think, like, I used this map last time and it didn't quite feel right. Maybe I should use a different map for it.
And also, invariably, there is the situation of you find a map that'll do okay for whatever you're running, and then a few days after you run that encounter, you find the perfect map.
Yes.
And it's like, ugh.
It is funny, though, because in our Marodi campaign, there's been a couple times when I do that between sessions, but it was a cliffhanger. So when you guys come back, the field that you were standing on looks completely different. Because this looks much better now. The other thing, though, when you're talking about reusing things from a role-playing standpoint, there are times when I don't know how I'm going to run an NPC, and the way the players react to them helps me figure out what that NPC acts like and what their mannerisms are. And from then on, I know that NPC. I'm not starting from scratch when I use that character again.
Right. And you have an idea of how the players might react to them.
So what types of things should you be careful about reusing when you're using something that you've run before?
Speaking of knowing how your players might react to something, when you're reusing something, you need to remember very clearly and strongly in your heart, different players are going to do different things. You can take the notes and the outline of the adventure that you have prepared from the past. You can take those encounters, but you can't always count on the players doing exactly what they've done in the past. So you need to make sure that you are prepared to adjust things on the fly or not be tied to certain things that happened in the past. You know, those certain things may have been very key to the previous group that played through that scenario, but may not matter to the new group, and you have to, you know, the writer, what is it the writers say? Kill your darlings.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be prepared to let some of those things go as things take a turn for whatever the new group is doing.
Yeah, that's I have run into that, especially when I was in organized play, where when I had run something like maybe 3 or 4 times, there were times when it's like, oh, the last 2 times, people always found this thing. So I don't need to give them any clues that this thing is over here. And then you go through the 3rd time and nobody's going anywhere near the thing. Nobody's picking up on anything. And you're like, oh, man, now I have to drop a clue in here. I can't run this the way I have the last couple times.
I had a thing I was running at conventions. It wasn't D&D, but it was a fantasy game. And the whole concept was, is the PCs are sent out to go to this trade town and find out about a caravan that went missing, and then go find said missing caravan. Very straightforward adventurer. Go to this location, ask questions, and then go find the missing thing. It generally went pretty smooth every time I ran it before. I ran it probably about 4 times. Went pretty smooth, except for one time I ran it at Origins, and I have this player who refused to leave the trade town. He kept coming up with more questions to ask, more things to do. I was trying to accommodate what the players are engaging with, and nobody else seemed to be too upset, but he just kept eating away at the amount of time I had to run this session. And I finally had to pick up the caravan and move it to just across the river from the trade town on the other side of the bridge in a little village that wasn't actually there, but it was for them to have any sort of satisfying conclusion to this adventure, which all of the other players absolutely deserved, even if this guy refused to engage with things.
Yeah.
Get them over there. They found the missing caravan, found the kidnapped caravan driver, saved the day, yada, yada, yada. Everyone was like, yeah, that was a good game left, except for the guy who dragged his feet. And he's like, yeah, that was fun, but it was way too much of a railroad.
Oh, goodness. And that's the thing. We're talking about things you shouldn't reuse, and we're talking about assumptions that you shouldn't reuse. One of the things that's really interesting about players is you can get a much different feel when you have a group where everyone is engaged and everyone is pushing buttons and turning dials. And if one person doesn't pick up on something, somebody else will. And then if you get another party where they're all great people, but none of them are proactive, you can't run that game the same way for them.
One other thing I'll say about something to be careful of when reusing materials. You don't want to do this to a group you've already run the game for.
Yeah.
It is one thing if a player chooses to be in a game where they know they've been through it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have run something for your players, reusing that, even if you file the serial numbers off and change it just a little bit, your players are going to know.
Yeah.
Your players are going to remember. This is a general piece of advice I will give to GMs. Be mindful of what your tropes are, because a lot of times GMs who don't think about the tropes they fall back on will reuse the same tropes over and over again. And players who play their games multiple times will be like, oh yeah, I've been here, done this.
I had this brilliant idea that of having my party start in media res. I had them in the middle of a fight and I had them explain, okay, what went wrong in this job? And I didn't realize a few months later, I did that same thing again. And one of the players pointed it out and I was like, nah.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. Carnivals, amusement parks, fairs. I have to be careful about reusing those. When Captain America Winter Soldier came out, me and a friend were sitting in the audience and we both looked at each other and it's a that guy game, because we had a friend who would constantly have lost World War II bunkers show up in his game that we would have to explore to find clues about what was going on. And it was just like, you got to be careful of your tropes. It's okay to reuse ideas and concepts, but be mindful of when you're using them as a crutch rather than a tool.
And I think the last thing I'll say about being careful about reusing things is to talk about the mechanical. Sometimes, if you think, man, this villain that I used went down really easily, think about what happened in the fight. If multiple people got crits and you were rolling terrible, that isn't showing you what that NPC or monster can actually do. And if you think the next time you run this adventure, you're going to amp that character up, that may not be what you need to do. You know, there's always times when you have to understand the context of what happened. So be really careful when you think, you know, make sure that it wasn't a fluke the first time that people blew through that encounter.
Right. And I've talked about this before in the past. There was a difference between my regular Saturday group and the kids I was running mm-hmm. through D&D. My Saturday players are extremely savvy, competent players who pick up on small things, who are very tactically minded. We blow through stuff that is supposed to be super hard or difficult encounters. Meanwhile, the kids, they weren't very experienced with D&D. I sometimes had to like tone things down a little bit, or they would have, you know, like something that the other group would have just breezed through would have taken those kids out. So you have to be mindful of the experience level of the players you're bringing this encounter to.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny that you mentioned your Saturday game because, you know, like my daughter's group, they were so excited to have their druid cast heat metal on the paladin sword because I was going to let her do extra damage, even though it was damaging the paladin. And it's like, not good tactics, but they were so excited that they could use a spell in a way that it wasn't meant to be used to do something neat with it.
In my kids' game, my niece was like playing a druid, and she's like, I want to bonk something. I want to hit it with my stick. And I kept being like, honey, you have a spell for this. It's called Shillelagh. It makes your stick magical so you can bonk them harder. Oh, okay, I guess I'll do that. But it was just like, so excited to just hit something. And it's like, there's more tactics here. There's more stuff you can do.
But why isn't the spell just called Bonk and Stick? Let's take a moment and talk about published adventures. Is there any difference between rerunning those versus rerunning your homebrew material?
I would say that you still need to prep running a published adventure. So if you've run it before, you have an idea of where things, you know, need to be adjusted, where things, because like, I love published adventures. They're great for ideas. Sometimes I wonder if the authors of published adventures have ever actually played with real players, because they will make assumptions about what players will do that no player would actually do, unless a GM forces them to because they're railroading them through a published adventure. I think published adventures probably get reused more than people's homebrew games.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably a little more, I don't know, leeway with running them for different groups.
We'll talk about this a little bit more later, but I have run Storm King's Thunder all the way through, and I was also a player in Storm King's Thunder after I had run it. If you ever sit down at a table with a published adventure and try and run it out of the book without having read it first, please do not do that.
I'm sitting here making a face. Don't do that thing.
No.
Even when you are reading the adventure and trying to parse it before you bring it to the table, there are still times you're just like, what the hell are they thinking here? What are they referencing? Where is this? And that's when I go to the PDF and I start searching for certain words.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those issues of, we all prep for what makes us comfortable for running.
Yes.
Pre-written adventures are written by people who this may be the way they run.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way everyone else runs. So you need to be mindful of figuring out what the moving pieces of that published adventure are before you bring it to the table.
There have been times when I look at a published adventure's map and I go, I don't know where the exit is at here. And even when it's clearly marked with letters, I'm like, I'm lost, because there's like 30 different locations on this map. And part of what I will do when I prep for things like this is I'll like put a post-it note saying, it's right here. This is the exit. If they go to this room, don't forget the exit is right by that. And that's one of those things that when you have run something before, you already know that. You already have that in your head that that's something that you need to do. One of the things, I actually wrote a whole blog post after I ran Storm King's Thunder about what I would do if I ran it again. There were several points in that adventure. And by the way, I am not criticizing anyone that writes published adventures that does not make things as clear for everyone that reads it as they possibly could. There's always limitations. Something's going to get missed. I get it. But there are a couple locations in Storm King's Thunder that are obviously pointing to other locations, but neither encounter says that they have anything to do with the other encounter. you will go to a certain town and interact with this tribe of Uthgard barbarians, and they talk about how this person is missing, and nowhere in that encounter does it say, you will find this person in, you know, chapter 3 in section blah, blah, blah. And I'm reading through, like, this layer of this polar worm later on, and I'm like, oh, that's their dead body. But they never said that, so I just described that as a dead body and didn't make that connection when my players went through there, so they never got to go back and talk to those people because it didn't expressly say, this is it. This is that thing that we talked about in the earlier chapter.
Yeah. Again, no shade on the people who write adventures. I've written adventures. It's not published yet, but I've written adventures, and it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard making sure everything's there that needs to be there in a format that is easily understood and digestible.
I think that's actually an interesting thing, like, to segue into a little bit of, you know, old D&D versus modern D&D. When that happens now, it tends to be because it's a really big adventure and somebody didn't come back through and make that reference that you should go back and look here.
Mm-hmm.
In older adventures, that was intentional because you had some of the old school designers that thought, if you're going to DM, you're going to have to put these things together. I'm not going to tell you that these things go together.
Yeah.
You need to get good and figure out how all this stuff goes together. And that's actually what kept me from running published adventures for a lot of my early career.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, you do need to prep published adventures. And if you're going to run a published adventure again, you've done a lot of that work. Man, it is really interesting, though, to see other people interpret things, because I've run Lost Mine of Phandelver multiple times, and I had one party that was just like, oh, we're going to talk to people, we're going to get a job, we're going to go do that job, then we're going to go back and we'll talk to somebody else. And then I had another party that was like, we're going to explore this thing, that's a red wizard, we're going to attack him, oh my gosh, he fireballed and killed three of us. There's going to be a little bit of difference there. So the funny thing is, from that point on, I developed certain personality traits for that red wizard that I characterize that red wizard with from then on if I ran it again, because I basically turned it into, like, I don't want to fight. I'm evil, but I don't want to kill people. So is there a difference between reusing material for a home game versus a public one-shot?
I would say that reusing material is almost a requirement for convention one-shots. Like I mentioned earlier, you want those scenarios in your back pocket that you know how to run. That you can pull out at a convention. I will regularly playtest my convention one-shots before I bring them to a convention, because when you are at a convention, more than likely people have paid to be there and play your game. Whether or not they had to pay a ticket fee to get into your game or just pay to be at the convention itself, they have paid to be there. You are still a player at that table. You still deserve to have fun. But you have agreed to provide an experience for those players that have come to your table. So you really want to be comfortable in running whatever adventure you're putting on for that convention. Running it as a playtest with your friends at home gives you an idea of where it might be too long, where it might be too short, where your encounter might be too easy, too hard, clues that might not be as obvious as you thought they were. And allows you to know those areas where you need to adjust. And then there is also that thing I mentioned back at the beginning about how absolutely delightful it is to see how different people approach the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
I have a one-shot I bring to conventions called The Lost Star of Wendover. Every single group has solved, you know, completed the ending in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just brilliant to see how they do it. And like one of the ones I love is that my friend who was in my playtest, who played the druid, was like, oh, how did the group at Gen Con do it? And I told him how they solved it. And he's like, they could do that? They could solve it that way? Oh, man, why didn't we think of that? And that's just, it's so much fun to see that type of thing with one shots. And you don't get that unless you are running the same scenario multiple times.
And I think, you know, one of those things that's really important in understanding the difference between that home game and your public game is you might run a scenario and you run through everything except that final boss fight and everybody's raring to go. And in your home game, you're like, oh, everybody's got to go home. We'll just wrap this up next week. And you can't do that at a convention.
No.
And if you find out there are certain parts of the adventure that when you're running at home are the big highlights that everybody loved, you might have to cut out everything that aren't those parts for the convention.
Yeah, you really need to be able to bring it in under the time limit for a convention one-shot. There are two things I find frustrating with convention one-shots. One is the DM who sits down at the table and runs it from the module, and he has never actually run it before.
Yep.
I find that incredibly disrespectful and a waste of my time, because I have paid money to be at that convention, maybe bought a ticket for that game. And for them to waste my time like that, I have standards.
Mm-hmm.
I have standards. I don't appreciate that. The other one is the GM who doesn't know how to manage their time. And you get to about 15 minutes before the end of the session, they're like, we've still probably got an hour to go. You guys can stay, right? It's like, no. Even if I don't have anything to do, I probably have lunch plans with friends, or, you know, I need to do something before my next game, or I just want to go back to the room or the hotel and hang out with my friends. You know, it's like, you respect your player's time.
Yeah.
You need to do this with your home game as well, but there's a little more leeway.
Oh, yeah.
There's a little more wiggle room for things. But for a convention game, respect your player's time and their presence in your game.
I know not everyone is like me, but as much as I love being at conventions, I have to plan a lot of times to have at least an hour between events. Like, I can't go from one event right to another, because I have to de-stress. I have fun, but there is a certain level of I am around a lot of people that I'm not used to, and it's loud and it's crowded, and that anxiety level starts going up, and I just need to go somewhere quiet and recharge for that hour in between sessions. And if you run over, even if, you know, you still have the space and all of that, that person that may need that time isn't going to get that time.
I mentioned the game I ran several years ago. It was probably 2017, so it was many years ago, basically, where I had a completely non-proactive table. I literally had to kind of shove them to the finale of that game. They spent probably 60% of the time of the session investigating something that should have only taken 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
maybe an hour, but they spent 2.5 hours. So all of the other things that were in that game that they could have been exploring, investigating, engaging with, I had to just slash and cut and get them, you know, like, here's the blunt clue. This is where you need to go for the finale and get the thing. And like, even then, we only had like 15 minutes left. So I had each of them narrate one thing they did to defeat the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one guy, but we should be playing this. And I'm like, yes, we should.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys didn't get here in time. And now I'm trying to give you the finale of the game, so you at least have a complete story, because I'm not staying here one more minute longer than I have to.
Speaking about conventions, I'm going to ask you this. What about organized play? But I've been saving up a lot of stuff from some of these other questions for this question.
Yeah, I'm probably going to bounce this one right back at you, because I've kind of avoided organized play. I have thoughts, and they're not all kind, but I think organized play serves a very important purpose in our modern RPG hobby, but I don't think it's executed as well as it could be in a lot of situations. So, Jared, what about organized play?
Well, first, since you mentioned your mission statement about what organized play should be, I think organized play should be primarily to get new people into the game and give them a game when they don't have one to regularly play, to get people that are, you know, long-term players that don't currently have a game, and then everybody else. Where mm-hmm. I think a lot of organized play falls down, and this isn't one organized play, I've seen multiple organized play programs fall into this, it starts catering to the people that play organized play all the time. It's not the new person. It's not the person that doesn't have a home group. It's the people that are like professional organized play players, and the rules start to cater to them. And that usually makes it less friendly for the brand new people or the people that don't get to play that often.
I've never engaged with organized play at a friendly local game store or anything like that. My experiences have been at conventions, and as a new player, I very much felt like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You sign up for a game, they say there'll be characters provided, you show up, and all of the other players are like, what do you mean you don't have a character? What do you mean you need to take one of the pre-gens?
Ugh, yeah.
Come here, let me help you level your character up, because you should have this gear, and just, like, it's not welcoming.
I agree. When I was running Pathfinder Society, there became a sort of idea of this pregen is terrible and will ruin your party if anyone takes it. Everyone needs to buy their own wand of Cure Light Wounds because I am not going to waste my spell slots on you. I will take your Cure Light Wounds and heal you with it, but you have to pay for it because I want my spells for combat. There were things like that that when people say you should just know this, and it's like, no, you shouldn't. You're creating a barrier for people coming in here. However, I don't want to just make this about, hey, what can go wrong with organized play?
I don't like it, but to be fair, a lot of those people who get into it, they feel a sense of community mm-hmm. with the other people who play regularly.
Oh, yeah.
And there is value in that community. I just don't think it should be the sole purpose
yes.
of organized play.
Well, it's like I said, it shouldn't not cater to them, but I think the hierarchy should be what I mentioned before.
Yeah.
That said, organized play has definitely provided me with a lot of fun times. Everything that we've talked about having that shared experience and seeing people, replaying things and, getting the excitement of seeing somebody do something different in the same scenario, that is, up and down what you can get from organized play. So these are the good parts of organized play. This is why it is worth checking out and hoping that maybe, like your local scene will fit your type of gaming. But when it comes to, running things more than once, what you have to realize with organized play is you do get a wide range of people. You may not be able to prep that adventure one way and run it one way from then on. What I would have to do is when I got a group of people, especially when like 4 out of 6 of my people at the table were all people that were friends that went to organized play all the time and they were super tactical and all that, they weren't going to take as long with combats. Because they were going to do this thing where it's like, we cast this and we do this and, this person hits with this and that should do enough damage to kill it in one round. Hey, we're done. While that doesn't always seem fun for other people, it was fun for them to speed run the adventure. But I also didn't want to have it done in an hour and a half. So I had to make notes on, okay, if they're going to role play with this person, I want to make sure to hit these points a little bit more than I would if it was somebody that was taking longer tactically. If they're going to be looking for this side thing that they're supposed to be, able to get because of their faction missions, I need to make sure that I maybe make it a little more challenging for that tactical group because they're going to be spending more time on this than they are this boss fight that they're going to breeze through. In that case, organized play sometimes requires you to kind of do parallel, versions of your prep.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing about that is part of your prep is learning what scenes to jettison. Because, like you said, I saw too many things in organized play where people were like, oh, well, we probably still have an hour to go, and the session is wrapping up, so I'm going to tell you, there is this vault with this lich, and then this trap happens, and then you have to do this, and this, and this, and this, and here are your sheets, you get all these magic items, you get this, I hope you had a wonderful experience from me taking 5 minutes to explain what would have been another hour of adventuring. And the thing is, if that's going to be the end of the adventure and they're not going to miss something vital to the story of the adventure, get rid of some of those things in the middle. And part of your prep is saying this encounter only happens if we need it to. I had it down to where it was like, okay, if we get 2 hours in and they aren't here, this one's going out automatically. I just know I'm going to throw this one out. That's kind of rough because you do have to play through it sometimes and kind of get in that time crunch once in a while in order to realize that you're going to have to do some of those things. And that's where maybe if you do have organized play that you would like to run multiple times for, find some friends that also maybe want to, play through an organized play adventure so that you can, like you were talking about with some of your scenarios for conventions, play through it with your home group so you realize, oh no, this thing's going to take way too long.
If I remember correctly, one of the reasons I stopped signing up for early Adventurer League type stuff is some of them were 6-hour sessions.
Yes.
And I'm very comfortable in the 4-hour session at conventions. I really don't want to spend 6 hours on one game.
some organized play have done some things to what they think is accommodating, and I don't actually think it helps. Pathfinder Society for a while went from 4 hours to 5 hours, which screws with a lot of convention slots, because a lot of conventions don't have 5 hour slots.
Or if they do, it's because they have an hour gap between slots. That's meant to be the, like, go grab yourself something to eat, go grab a refreshment, go browse the dealer's room and spend money on the people who paid to be here. You know, and if you steal that away from players, that's not good for the convention as a whole.
And Adventurers League did a thing where they were putting out adventures that if your people go straight to the thing, it's a 2 hour adventure. If they engage with this part of it, it's a 4 hour adventure. If they decide to do all this other optional stuff, it's a 6 hour adventure. I did not like that either. There were things that were written to be 1 hour adventures, and a lot of those were really good and really focused, and you could run them in 1 hour because 5e is actually pretty agile, especially at lower levels. You know, it doesn't take you forever to do a combat. It doesn't take you forever to resolve some of these things. But I would much rather someone say this was designed for an hour and it runs in an hour than to say, well, some people have problems with this coming in at an hour, so maybe it's a 3 hour slot now. I don't think that helps people get used to what they need to learn about running for organized play.
Again, this might be a little bit of a tangent. One of my issues with organized play is I want organized play to teach new GMs.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to teach GMs not just how to run that system, but how to be a good GM. And I don't think enough of them offer the advice or the tools that people need to better, you know, run a game. The number of organized play GMs who have shown up to the table without having read the adventure is just offensive.
Yeah.
I've never run into that at Origins or Gen Con, but I have run into it at smaller cons, and it's still just like, no, I'm giving you 4 hours of my life. I am not here for you to read the book at me. I wish they would do better about vetting their GMs and making sure their GMs have the tools to know how to run things. And that's having the, hey, you want to fit it in this 4 hour time slot. You want to do the opening. You want to do the finale. What you do in the middle, you want to have something cool in there. But if you need to cut out this thing, cut out this thing.
And another thing that's a little trickier in Adventurers League, which is something I liked, but is also tricky, is that you can run the regular hardcover adventures. And this is not as much of a problem now, because now there are rules to where basically it's like, if you played 4 hours and you want to level up, you can level up. But if you level up past what this adventure accommodates, you're not playing the adventure anymore. So it's up to you whether you want to level your character up fast or whether you want to keep playing that adventure. But before that was the case, when you were running something like Curse of Strahd, you had to be mindful, because even if you had run Curse of Strahd with your home group, and even if you have, you know, played this before, you need to find them a milestone where you can cap things off and say you get this many XP and you get these items and everything by the end of the night. You're not necessarily trying to get them to speedrun, but you are kind of looking at where the next milestone is so that they have an actual ending point if they don't come back for 3 weeks and they don't play this again.
Yeah.
That was a lot of oxygen used on organized play, and I had feelings, and I put in a lot of hours for that. So looking at this from the player side of things, what about playing in adventures that you've played before?
You're going to be able to talk to this because, as you mentioned before, you ran Storm King's Thunder and then played in Storm King's Thunder. I've had the situation before where I didn't have anything else to do and a GM was running something I had already played, so I just jumped in the game. You need to be respectful of the other players. Just because you know where the MacGuffin is doesn't mean you speedrun there because you can ignore all the clues. No, you take a more passive role and support the other players in an adventure you've already played. If you didn't realize it was going to be the same adventure the GM has run, just privately let them know, hey, I already played this. You know, that can be like the thing that happened to Jared and me, where players are like, didn't you already run this before? And you're like, no, but crap. It's like, you can still have fun playing something you've already experienced before, but you do need to be respectful about the other people who are experiencing it for the first time.
Actually, because it's in the public zeitgeist, I am going to throw this out here. Playing something that you've already played in or run is almost like watching X-Men 97. There are a bunch of elements that I know from reading the comics in the 80s and 90s, but they are in a different order and they happen in different ways and they're being combined in ways that can still surprise me. And that's what can happen a lot if you're playing this adventure with different people. One of the things that was neat when we were playing Storm King's Thunder is I talked to John about that. And essentially, I had a character that he wasn't dumb, but he wasn't extremely bright, but he was very focused on knowing about giants. What would happen there is John could hand it off to me to do exposition about giants, and I could tell people general stuff about giants. But if we got to a point to where I knew that something was like, oh, this is a decision point, and I know where each direction goes, I wouldn't make the decision. And I think that's an important thing to remember when you're playing. Sometimes you can play through it again. You can't, I don't think you can play through as someone that's going to be a leader in the party.
Yeah.
I think you really have to be in a support role to do that well.
In some ways, you need to be part of the supporting cast rather than a lead.
Mm-hmm.
You can still play, you can still enjoy it, but take a step back and let the other players make decisions. In a lot of ways, in that Storm King Thunders game, Nograt was our tour guide.
Yeah.
Like, he'd be like, oh, this is a such and such, and, you know, oh, this is such and such.
That was a tour guide that got to roll for initiative and get into fights, so that was fun.
Yeah.
One of the other things that is kind of neat, and it's something that you can do only when you've had somebody that's played through these things before, is if you have someone that knows they shouldn't be making the decision or they shouldn't be solving the puzzle, but the rest of the party gets stumped, it's really great to have that person where the GM can nod to them and kind of go, okay, you can give them a hint now. You can push them in the right direction. And what's kind of neat is, as long as you don't just go and do the thing yourself, you're just saying, maybe turn that to the left. Yeah, you know, as long as you're doing something like that, it still feels like the party solved the thing, because when they got into that jam, it's not the DM that gave them the hint. It's somebody else in the party that gave them the hint.
Yeah.
And I think that's a neat thing that you can do that you wouldn't have otherwise if you didn't have somebody that was in on it. It's almost like having a co-GM or an assistant director that's, you know, also an actor in the film.
Yeah.
I don't know how many more ways I can mangle what it's like to play through something here. It's like a nostalgic cartoon where you're also an assistant director. There you go.
No, it's fun. You can do it. Be respectful of the other players. Take a back seat. Let them take the lead.
Do you have anything else that you can think of about running adventures again?
Like I mentioned at the beginning, recycling ideas is perfectly valid.
Mm-hmm.
I am about to start a campaign with some other friends. It's not D&D, so I'm not going to talk too much about it, but I'm going to start a campaign with friends that is reusing a campaign concept I did a decade and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
That I enjoyed, but I feel like now I have the skills to do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And better, and keep a more consistent tone with it. You can reuse your ideas. I've spent so many years playing this game. I've spent many years now running this game or games, and there's just a lot of cool ideas out there that they still have legs.
Oh, yeah.
You can still reuse them with different people and do different things with them.
One of the things that I tend to do at the end of a campaign, you know, if I've run a series of adventures or like a big campaign hardcover or something like that, is I will do a postmortem of the campaign at the end of it. That is basically me just sitting down and going, okay, what parts of this were rough? What parts of this went really great? Would I swap this monster out for that monster? And me, because I have a blog and I can't stop typing, most of these are on my blog, but consider doing that. You know, do that postmortem after the game and think about how things went, because that may convince you that, hey, this went really well, but it could go even better if I did all these things that I noticed.
There are reasons to reuse stuff you've done before.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
So, moving on into our downtime research segment. Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to you, our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. This week, we've talked about Dimension 20 before, but I wanted to give a little nudge towards them again. Brennan Lee Mulligan is always a joy to watch as a GM. On the show, they are currently doing the third season of Fantasy High. It's a mashup of D&D and 1980s high school dramas.
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious. As a caveat, I haven't actually been watching the full episodes because APs and I, actual plays and I, have a bit of a fraught relationship. It's hard for me to give them the attention they deserve. But they have been putting out a lot of shorts that are absolutely delightful in the way they highlight the game, both in the growth of these characters and their relationships together, but also the times they absolutely flummox Brennan. This is something every GM should get used to when a player completely and legitimately, legally, completely sends your carefully crafted plan spiraling into chaos. Specifically, I'm talking about Gorgug's barbarian abilities completely stopping Brennan and his bad guy in their tracks. I'll have a link to Dropout TV and Dimension 20 in the show notes, but you can also find them on YouTube for their shorts.
You can talk about Brennan and, you know, his pacing and his, you know, stories and his characters, but one of the things that is great about Brennan is he rolls with what people throw at him. He may look like a deer in the headlights for a few seconds, but he doesn't try and push them down a certain road. He is the opposite of any kind of railroading. It is like, this is the path that you have chosen. We are going to explore it now. The other thing I was going to say is, compared to some other APs, it is a nice balance because they aren't one shots, but they're organized into seasons. So it's not quite like trying to jump into Critical Role that, you know, runs campaigns for multiple years at a time. You're only going to watch, like, you know, a certain number of episodes and then the season is done. And then if you want to watch the next season, you can come back later and do that. And, you know, and there's also different levels of engagement, because if you have Dropout, you can watch like the extended things where they do interviews with people and they talk about the people that make the miniatures and all this stuff like that. So you can adjust the level that you want to engage with it. And I think that's pretty neat. I'm going to talk about something that there is not a chance in hell I will ever buy, but I love looking at these. The Vecna Eve of Ruin Platinum Edition is up on Beetle and Grimms. And if you've never heard of Beetle and Grimms, they're a premium D&D third-party company. They make a campaign box, so they will break down the adventure and put it into individual chapters, so it's a little bit easier to reference. They will come up with, you know, like, you know, different play aids and things like that. It is not cheap. There are varying levels depending on the adventure, and sometimes there's like lesser versions where they don't put all the bells and whistles in there, but the Eve of Ruin Platinum Edition is $500. This is what you get, though, for those $500. They have cards that represent the pieces of the Rod of Seven Parts, but they're aluminum plated and they slide together. They have battle maps of all of the major locations, so you're not drawing something out or guessing what it should look like. They have all of the handouts that would normally appear in the book, where you would have to read them to somebody or maybe make a copy. They have really nice, fancy, you know, handouts for all of those. They have a custom DM screen. They have a bunch of coins. They have 65 encounter cards, which are like just the monster and its stats and what you need for when you get into a fight with them. And on top of that, they have the pre-painted WizKids minis for Vecna, Tasha, Illustrial, and like 10 more medium minis and a few more large minis. And some of these even have like a custom paint job that you won't get if you buy those minis in the regular sets.
Are you sure you're not going to buy it? Because you certainly sound like you're talking yourself into buying it.
I'm not going to buy this, but I am going to say that I started looking at the Curse of Strahd set that they have, and it restocks this summer. I'm not going to say anything other than that. It's not as expensive as the Platinum Edition, though. But if you would just like to see the kind of things that go into these things, to browse these things, to dream about what your campaign may look like if you had unlimited funds, I'm going to put a link in the show notes for the Platinum Edition of Eve of Ruin. But once you're on Beetle and Grimm's site, you can poke around and see all the other boxes that they have. They're pretty neat. We're happily part of the Polygamerus Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamerus podcast like
Pandas Talking Games, queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Pandas Phil and Senda every Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. Get cozy and let's talk about some games.
Got a lot of P's going on there.
Yeah.
We've used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.